body. Mr. Catalides picked himself up, dusted his hands together, and beamed at me.
"Miss Stackhouse, how nice to see you," he said, "and how clever of you to distract him. I'm not yet returned to full strength."
"I take it you know who this is?" I said, trying not to look at the inert figure of Donald Calloway.
"I do, and I've been looking for a chance to shut his mouth forever."
The bowl of sweet potatoes was still letting off steam. "I can't pretend to regret he's dead," I said, "but this whole incident is kind of shocking, and it's taken me a minute to collect myself. In fact, I've been through a lot of shocking stuff lately, but what else is new? Sorry, I'm babbling."
"I can quite understand that. Shall I tell you what I've been doing?"
"Yes, please. Have a seat and talk to me." It would give me a chance to recover. The demon sat opposite me and smiled in a cordial way.
"When last you saw me, you were given a baby shower, I believe, and the hellhounds were pursuing me. Do you mind if I impose on you for a glass of ice water?"
"Not at all," I said, and rose to fetch it. I had to step over the body.
"Thank you, my dear."
The lawyer finished the glass in one long swallow. I refilled it. I was glad to return to my seat. "You look kind of beat up," I observed, for I'd watched him as he drank. Mr. Catalides was usually very well turned out, in expensive suits that could not hide his round figure, but at least made him look prosperous. The suit he had on had certainly looked much better when he'd bought it. Now it was marred with snags and holes and frayed spots, and spotted with stains. His once polished brogans could not be salvaged. Even his socks were in tatters. The tonsure of dark hair was full of debris, leaves, and twigs. Could it be he hadn't had a chance to change clothes since I'd last seen him sitting here in this kitchen, taking a time out from his pursuit by four-legged streaks of darkness?
"Yes," he said, looking down at his condition. "Kind of beat up is a gentle way to put it. Those streaks of darkness were hellhounds."
It was no shock to me that he could read my mind. My own telepathy had been a birth present from Mr. Catalides. He'd always been very good at concealing his own gift, never betraying by so much as a glance that he could read human minds. But I'd figured he must have it if he could give it away.
"The hellhounds pursued me for a very long time, and I had no idea why. I could not fathom what I had done to offend their master."
He shook his head.
"Now, of course, I know."
I waited for him to tell me what he'd done, but he wasn't ready for that.
"Finally, I became far enough ahead of the hounds to take time to arrange an ambush. By then, Diantha had been able to find me to join in the surprise I'd planned for them. We had quite a struggle with the hounds."
He was silent for a moment. I looked at the stains on his clothing and took a deep breath. "Please tell me Diantha isn't dead," I said. His niece, Diantha, was one of the most unusual creatures I'd ever met, and that was saying something, considering whom I could enter in my address book.
"We prevailed," he said simply. "But it cost us, of course. I had to lie hidden in the woods for many days until I was able to travel again. Diantha recovered more quickly, since her wounds were slighter, and she brought me food and began gathering information. We needed to understand before we could begin to dig ourselves out of trouble."
"Uh-huh," I said, wondering where this was going to lead. "You want to share that information with me? I'm pretty sure that this guy didn't understand my grand's letter." I nodded my head at the body.
"He may not have understood the context, and he didn't believe in fairies, but he did see the phrase, cluvial door,"
Mr. Catalides said. "But how come he knew it was valuable? He definitely didn't know what it can do, because he didn't understand the reality of fairies."
"I learned from my sponsor, Bertine, that Calloway googled the term cluvial door. He found one reference in a fragment of text from an old Irish folktale,"
Mr. Catalides said. This Bertine must be Mr. Catalides' godmother, in effect, the same way Mr. Catalides, my grandfather's best friend, was mine. I wondered briefly what Bertine looked like, where she lived. But Mr. Catalides was still talking.
Computers are another reason to deplore this age, when no one has to really travel to learn important things from other cultures.
He shook his head, and a fragment of leaf floated to the floor and landed on the corpse.
And I'll tell you more about my sponsor when we have some leisure. You might like her.
I suspected Mr. Catalyades also had flashes of foreseeing.
Fortunately for us, Calloway came to Bertine's attention when he persisted in his research. Of course, it was unfortunate for him.
Mr. Catalyades spared a downward glance at the inert Donald.
Calloway tracked down a supposed expert in fairy lore, someone who could tell him what little is known about this legendary fairy artifact, namely, the fact that none exist on this earth anymore. Unfortunately, this expert, who was Bertine, as you have no doubt surmised, did not understand the importance of keeping silent, since dear Bertine didn't believe that there were any cluvial doors left in either world. She felt free to talk about them. Therefore, she was ignorant of the wrong she committed when she told Calloway that a cluvial door could be made in almost any form or shape. Calloway had never suspected the item he'd held was an actual fey artifact until he talked to Bertine. He imagined scholars and folklorists would give a pretty penny to possess such a thing.
When he showed me the drawer, I didn't get that he'd already opened it, I said quietly. How could that be?
Were you shielding?
I'm sure I was. I did it without thinking, to protect myself. Of course, I couldn't maintain such a level of blocking all day, every day. And, of course, it protected your brain only like wearing earmuffs affected your hearing. A lot of stuff still filtered in, especially from a strong broadcaster. But apparently Donald had been preoccupied that day, and I had been so excited at the contents of the drawer, I hadn't realized he was seeing the Butterick pattern envelope and the velvet bag for the second time. He hadn't believed he'd found anything valuable or notable, a confusing letter from an old woman about having children and getting a present, and a bag containing an old toiletry item, maybe a powder compact. It was when he'd thought the find over later and Googled the odd phrase that he'd begun to wonder if those items might be valuable.
I need to give you lessons, child, as I should have done before. Isn't it nice that we're finally getting to know one another? I regret that it takes a huge crisis to impel me to make this offer.
I nodded faintly. I was glad to learn something about my telepathy from my sponsor, but it was kind of daunting to think of Desmond Catalyades becoming part of my everyday life. Of course, he knew what I was thinking, so I said hurriedly, "Please tell me what happened next."
When Diantha thought of questioning Bertine, Bertine realized what she had done. Far from giving a human a useless bit of information about old fairy lore, she had revealed a secret. She came to me while I was recuperating, and I finally understood why I'd been pursued.
Because, I tried to arrange my thoughts, because you'd kept secret the existence of a cluvial door?
Yes. My friendship with Fenton, whose name your grandmother mentioned in the letter, was no secret. Stupid Calloway Googled Fenton, too. And though he didn't find out anything about the real Fenton, the conjunction of the two searches sent out an alarm that eventually reached the wrong ears. The fact that Fenton was your grandfather is no secret either, since Niall found you and chose to honor you with his love and protection. It would not take much to put these snippets together.
This is the only cluvial door left in the world? Awesome.
Unless one lies lost and forgotten in the land of the Fae. And believe me, there are plenty who search every day for such a thing.
Can I give it away?
You'll need it if you're attacked. And you will be attacked,
Mr. Catalyades said matter-of-factly.
You can use it for yourself, you know. Loving yourself is a legitimate trigger of its magic. Giving it to someone else would seal their death warrant. I don't think you'd want that, though my knowledge of you is inadequate.
Gee, a lot of swell news.
I wish Adele had used it herself, to save her own life or the life of one of her children, to take the burden from you. I can only suppose that she didn't believe in its power.
Probably not, I agreed. and if she had, she almost certainly felt that using it would not be a Christian act. So, who's after the Cluvial Door? I guess you know by now.
I'm not sure that knowledge would be good for you, he said.
How come you can read my mind, but I can't read yours? I asked, tired of being transparent. Now I knew how other people must feel when I plucked a thought or two from their brains. Mr. Catalyades was a master at this, while I was very much a novice. He seemed to hear everything, and it didn't seem to bother him. Before I'd learned to shield, the world had been a babble of talk inside my head. Now that I could block those thoughts for the most part, life was easier, but it was frustrating when I actually wanted to hear. I seldom got a full thought or understood its context. It was surprisingly deflating to realize that it wasn't how much I heard that was amazing, it was how much I missed.
Well, I am mostly a demon, he said apologetically, and you're mostly only human.
Do you know Barry? I asked, and even Mr. Catalyades looked a little surprised.
Yes, he said after a perceptible hesitation. The young man who can also read minds. I saw him in Rhodes, before and after the explosion.
If I came to be telepathic because of your, well, essentially your baby shower present, how come Barry is telepathic? Mr. Catalyades pulled himself straight and looked anywhere but at me.
Barry is my great-great-grandson.
So you're much older than you look. This was taken as a compliment.
Yes, my young friend, I am. I don't neglect the boy, you know. He doesn't really know me, and of course he doesn't know his heritage, but I've kept him out of a lot of trouble. Not the same thing as having a fairy godmother as you had, but I've done my best.
Of course, I said, because it hadn't been my intent to accuse Mr. Catalyades of ignoring his own kin. I'd just been curious. Time to change the subject before I told him that my own fairy godmother had gotten killed defending me. Are you going to tell me who's after the Cluvial Door? He looked profoundly sorry for me. There was a lot of that going around.
Let's get rid of this body first, shall we?
He said.
Do you have any disposal suggestions?
I so seldom had to dispose of a human body myself, I was at a loss. Fairies turned into dust, and vampires flaked away. Demons had to be burned. Humans were very troublesome. Mr. Catalyades, picking up on that thought, turned away with a small smile.
I hear Diantha coming, he remarked. Maybe she'll have a plan.
Sure enough, the skinny girl glided into the room from the back door. I hadn't even heard her enter or detected her brain. She was wearing an eye-shattering combination, a very short yellow and black striped skirt over royal blue leggings and a black leotard. Her black ankle boots were laced up with broad white laces. Today, her hair was bright pink.
Sookie, you doing okay? She asked.
It took me a second to translate, and then I nodded. We gotta get rid of this, I said, pointing to the body, which was absolutely obvious in a kitchen the size of mine.
That shuts one door, she said to her uncle.
He nodded gravely.
I suppose the best way to proceed is to load him into the trunk of his car, Mr. Catalyades said. Diantha, do you think you could assume his appearance?
Diantha made a disgusted face, but quickly bent to Donald Calloway's face and stared into it. She plucked a hair from his head, closed her eyes. Her lips moved, and the air had that magic feel I'd noticed when my friend Amelia had performed one of her spells. In a moment, to my shock, Donald Calloway was standing in front of us, staring down at his own body. It was Diantha, completely transformed. She was even wearing Calloway's clothes, or at least that was the way she appeared to my eyes.
Fuck this shit,
Calloway said, and I knew Diantha was in charge. But it was beyond strange to see Mr. Catalyades and Donald Calloway carrying out Calloway's body to his car, unlocked with the keys extracted from the corpse's pocket. I followed them out, watching carefully to make sure nothing fell or leaked from the body.
Diantha, drive to the airport in Shreveport and park the car there. Call a cab to pick you up and have it drop you off at the police station. From there, find a good place to change back so they'll lose the trail.
She nodded with a jerk and climbed into the car.
Diantha can keep his appearance all the way to Shreveport?
I said, as she turned the car around with a grind of the wheel. He waved gaily as she took off like a rocket. I hoped she made it back to Shreveport without getting a ticket.
She won't get a ticket,
Mr. Catalides answered my thought. But here came Jason in his pickup.
Oh, hell, I said. His sweet potatoes aren't ready.
I need to say goodbye anyway,
Mr. Catalides said.
I know there are some things I haven't told you, but I must go now. I may have taken care of the hellhounds, but yours aren't my only secrets.
But
I might as well not have spoken. With a startling speed he'd shown when the hellhounds were chasing him, my sponsor disappeared into the woods.
Hey, sis!
Jason bounded out of his truck.
Did you just have a visitor? I passed a car. You got my sweet potatoes ready?
Not quite, I said. That was a drop-in I didn't expect, a guy wanting to sell me life insurance. You come in and sit, and they'll be ready in about 45 minutes. That was an exaggeration, but I wanted Jason to stay. I was scared to be alone. That was not a familiar feeling, or one I liked. Jason was willing enough to come in and gossip with me while I stood at the kitchen counter, adding ingredients to the sweet potatoes, mashing them, pouring them over the prepared crust, and putting the dish in the oven.
How come there's water everywhere?
Jason said, getting up from the chair to mop it off with a dry dish towel. I dropped a pitcher, I said, and that was the end of Jason's curiosity. We talked about the suggested wedding dates, the Durone babies, Hoyt and Holly's marriage, and Hoyt's idea that they have a double ceremony. I was sure Holly and Michelle would nix that, and the big reconciliation between Danny and Kennedy, who had been spotted kissing passionately in public at the Sonic. As I was pulling the casserole out of the oven and preparing to add the final layer, Jason said,
Hey, I guess you heard that all our old furniture got busted up. That stuff the antique dealer took? What was her name, Brenda? I hope you got money up front. It wasn't on consignment or nothing, right?
I'd frozen after lifting out the dish halfway, but I made myself continue with my task. It helped that Dermot came in then, and since he and Jason looked so much alike, Jason got the biggest kick out of telling Dermot how good he was looking every single time he saw our great uncle. No, I already got cash for that stuff, I said, when the Mutual Admiration Society had had its moment. And I got the distinct impression from Jason's head that he'd already forgotten that he'd asked me. By the time I'd finished my work and sent Jason on his way with the hot dish, Dermot had volunteered to fix hamburgers for our supper. Cooking was something else that he was interested in now, thanks to the Food Network and Bravo. While Dermot was frying the burgers and getting out anything we might want to put on the buns, I looked around the kitchen very carefully to make sure there weren't any traces of the incident.
Oh, come on, I said to myself. Donald Calloway's murder. Incident my round, rosy ass.
It turned out to be a good thing I checked, because under the kitchen table, I spied a pair of dark glasses that must have fallen out of Calloway's shirt pocket. Dermot didn't comment when I straightened and slid them into a drawer.
I don't guess you've heard from Claude or Niall, I said.
No. Maybe Niall has killed Claude, or maybe now that Claude is in Faerie, he just doesn't care anymore about those of us left here,
Dermot said, sounding simply philosophical. I really couldn't argue with him that those scenarios were impossible, because I knew enough about fairies and enough about Claude to know that they were actually likely. Are some of the guys coming to run out in the woods tonight? I said. I guess Bellanos and Gift told you about last night.
Those two won't be here tonight,
Dermot said, rather grimly.
I am making them work tonight as punishment. They hate cleaning the bathrooms and kitchen, so that's their duty after the club closes. They may come tomorrow night if they behave themselves.
I'm sorry about your car, niece.
All the Fae were calling me sister now, and Dermot almost always called me niece. There were a lot worse names they could have chosen, but all this familial terminology felt awfully intimate. The car's running okay, I said, though I'd have to get the bumper fixed sooner or later. Probably later. The seatbelt had to be replaced pronto. And I was a little taken aback that Dermot was punishing the sharp-toothed elf and his running buddy as he would little children, giving them the unpopular cleanup duty. But out loud, I said, at least they were able to get the car out of the ditch. I'm only worried they'll get spotted on someone else's land, or that they'll run into Bill.
He loves you,
Dermot said, turning over the hamburgers in the skillet.
Yeah, I know.
I got out two plates and a bowl of mixed fruit.
There's nothing I can do about it but be his friend, though. I used to love him back, and I gotta say there are moments when I feel the old attraction, but I'm not in love with Bill, not anymore.
You love the blonde one?
Dermot had been sure about Bill, but he didn't sound so sure about Eric.
Yes.
But I no longer felt the surge of love and lust and excitement I'd had before the past few weeks. I hoped I might feel all that again, but I was so emotionally battered that I'd gone a little numb. It was a curious feeling, as if my hand were asleep, but I expected it would be all pins and needles at any second.
I love him, I said.
But even to my own ears, I didn't sound happy about it. Chapter 11. You may wonder why I was willing to eat in the kitchen where I just witnessed a violent death. The fact is, Donald Calloway's demise was not the worst thing that had happened in my kitchen, not by a long shot. Maybe that was another thing I was getting numb to. Just before our food was ready, when Dermot's back was turned, I slid open the drawer and extricated the dead man's sunglasses, sliding them into my apron pocket. I admit, I can't say my legs were too steady when I excused myself to go to the bathroom. When I was safely shut inside, I put my hands over my face and sat on the edge of the tub to take a few deep breaths. I got up, dropping Donald Calloway's dark glasses onto the bath mat. I stomped on them three times, quickly. Without stopping to think, I held the bath mat over the waste can in a funnel shape and shook it gently until all the pieces were safely at the bottom of the plastic bag acting as a liner. After supper, I planned to take the bag out to the big garbage can that we had to wheel out to the road every Friday. When I heard Dermot calling me, I washed my hands and my face and left the bathroom, making myself stand straight. As I passed through my bedroom, I slipped the Cluvial door into my pocket, where the sunglasses had been. I couldn't leave it alone in my room, not anymore. The hamburgers were good, and I managed to eat mine and some fruit salad, too. Dermot and I were quiet together, which suited me fine. As we did the dishes, Dermot told me shyly that he had a date and would be going out after he showered.
Oh my gosh, I grinned at him. Who's the lucky girl?
Linda Tonneson?
The doctor?
Yes, he said a little doubtfully. I think that's what she said she did. Treats human ailments?
Oh, that's a big deal. Really, Dermot? I said. Doctors get a lot of respect in our society. I guess, as far as she knows, you're human?
He flushed.
Yes, she thinks I'm a very attractive human. I met her at the bar three nights ago.
It would be pretty stupid for me to comment further. He was handsome, sweet-natured, and strong. What more could a woman want? Besides, considering the confused state of my own love life, I could hardly pass out dating tips. I told Dermot I'd finish the dishes so he could go get ready for his date, and by the time I was ensconced on the living room couch with a book, he came downstairs in navy slacks and a pale blue striped shirt with a button-down collar. He looked amazing, and I told him so. He grinned at me.
I hope she'll think so, he said. I love the way she smells.
That was a very fairy compliment. Linda Tonneson was a smart woman with a great sense of humor, but she was not what humans thought of as conventionally pretty. Her smell had scored her big points with Dermot. I'd have to remember that. By the time Dermot left, dark had fallen. I got the bag containing Janilyn's jacket and went out the back door on my way to Bill's house. I felt a little better after I dropped the other little bag, the one containing the smashed dark glasses, into the garbage bin. I turned on my flashlight and strode to the woods. There was a little path. Bill came over often, probably far more often than I knew. Just before I reached the cleared ground of the old cemetery, I heard a sound to my left. I stopped in my tracks.
Bill? I said.
Sookie,
he answered, and then he was right in front of me. He had his own little plastic sack looped over his left hand.
We were all carrying bags around tonight. I brought Janilyn's jacket, I said, for you and Heidi.
You stole her jacket?
He sounded amused. If that were the worst thing I'd done today, I'd be a happy woman. Bill let that pass, though I could almost feel him peering at me. Vampire eyesight is excellent, of course. He took my arm, and we walked a few feet to get into the cemetery grounds. Even though there weren't many lights there, there were a few, and I could see, faintly, that Bill was excited about something. He opened my bag, put it to his face, and inhaled.
No, that's not a scent I picked up at the gate in the backyard. Of course, considering all the scents around there and the length of time before we were able to investigate, that can't be a definite no.
He handed it back. I felt almost disappointed. Janilyn made me so antsy that I would have liked to find her guilty of something, but I chided myself for being uncharitable. I should be glad Sam was dating an innocent woman, and I was, right?
You look unhappy, Bill said.
We were walking back to his house, and I tucked the plastic bag under my arm. I'd been thinking of how I'd return Janilyn's jacket to Sam's office. I'd have to do it soon. I am unhappy, I said. Then, because I didn't want to explain my every inner qualm, I told Bill, I listened to the news on the radio while I was cutting up sweet potatoes. That girl, Kim, the police are trying to blame her murder on a vampire because she died in Eric's front yard. Someone vandalized Fantasia, threw wet paint all over the exterior. Are Felipe and his crew still here? Why don't they go home? Bill put his arm around me.
Calm down, he said, his voice hard.
I was so surprised that I actually held my breath for a moment.
Breathe,
he commanded.
Slowly, thoughtfully.
What are you, Zen Master Fang?
Sookie.
When he used that voice, he meant business, so I took a deep breath, let it out. Again, again. Okay, I'm better, I said.
Listen, Bill said, and I raised my eyes to his.
He was looking excited again. He shook his own bag.
We've had all eyes open to try to track down Colton, or find his body. Very early this past morning, Palomino called from her job at the Trifecta. She's seen Colton. Felipe does have him. We've got a plan to get him out. Cobbled together, but I think it might work. If we can accomplish that, maybe we'll also discover where they're keeping Warren. If we find Warren and broadcast his whereabouts, Mustafa will come forward to tell what he knows. When Mustafa tells us who suborned him by holding Warren hostage, then we'll know who killed Kim. When we tell the police, the heat will be off Eric. Then we can solve the problem of that asshole Appius's posthumous betrothal of Eric to Freda. Felipe and his posse will go back to Nevada, Eric will have his sheriff's job, or a new title, but Felipe will not fire him or kill him.
That's a hell of a lot of dominoes, Bill. Colton to Warren to Mustafa to Kim's murderer to the police to Appius to Freda to Eric? Anyway, isn't it too late? We're doomed. Colton's probably already told him everything.
He can't have. Colton was grieving so hard over Audrina that I wiped his memory of her death. So he doesn't remember all of what happened that night, by any means.
You didn't tell Eric that, did you?
Bill shrugged. I didn't need his permission. It doesn't matter now, anyway. Felipe won't have Colton after tonight.
He brandished the bag he'd brought. Why?
Because you and I are going to kidnap him back.
And do what with him? Colton was a pretty nice guy, and he hadn't had what anyone would think of as an easy life. I didn't want to rescue him from Felipe, only to find that Bill planned to remove Colton as a witness in a very final way.
I have it all planned, but we have to act quickly. I've texted Harp to tell him we have to reschedule. I think this is more important than asking him questions about Kim's parents.
I had to agree. Say we get Colton out, I said, as we hustled toward Bill's car. What about Emmanuel? Can they track him in Los Angeles? Emmanuel, the hairdresser, also human, had been there that night since Victor's cruelty had led to his sister's death.
He got work on the set of a television show. Ironically, it's about vampires, and most of the shooting takes place at night. Two members of the crew are actually vampires. I put Emmanuel under the care of one of them. He'll be guarded.
How'd you arrange that?
Coincidence,
It happens, Bill said. And you're the other human, but you can't be glamored, so if we can just get Colton away and find Warren...
Since Warren never came into Fangtasia the night we killed Victor, I said, I don't believe his abduction has anything to do with Victor's death. I think Warren was snatched just to force Mustafa to let Kim Rowe in the back door of Eric's house.
I had enough light bulbs popping over my head to illuminate an operating room.
What do you think?
I think we have a lot of questions, Bill said. Now let's go find out some answers.
Our first stop was my house, where I left Janilyn's jacket and opened the bag Bill had brought.
Good God, I said in disgust. I got to wear that?
Part of the plan, Bill said, though he was smiling.
I stomped into my room and pulled on the blue, flirty skirt, which began well below my navel and ended about 2 inches below my happy place. The blouse, and it was a blouse in name only, was white with red trim and tied between my breasts. It was just like a bra with sleeves. I put on white Nikes with red trim, which was the best match I had on my shoe rack. There sure wasn't any pocket in this outfit, so I stuck the Cluvial door in my shoulder bag. While I was preparing for this secret mission, I put my phone on vibrate so it couldn't ring at an awkward moment. I looked in the bathroom mirror. I was as ready as I'd ever be. I felt ridiculously self-conscious when I came into the living room wearing the abbreviated outfit.
You look just right, Bill said soberly, and I caught the corner of his mouth twitching. I had to laugh.
I hope Sam doesn't decide we ought to dress this way at Merlot's, I said.
You would have a full house every night, Bill said.
Not unless I lost some weight. My glance in the mirror had reminded me that my stomach was not exactly concave.
You look mouth-watering,
Bill said, and to make his point, his fangs came down. He tactfully closed his mouth.
Oh, well.
I tried to accept this as an impersonal tribute, though I don't think any woman minds knowing she looks good, as long as the admiration isn't expressed in an offensive way and doesn't come from a disgusting source.
We better get going.
The Trifecta, a hotel casino on the east side of Shreveport, was the closest thing the town had to glamorous. At night, it glowed silver with so many lights I was sure you could see it from the moon. Since the lot was full, we were forced to park outside the fenced employee parking area. But the gate was open and unguarded at the moment, so we simply walked through the lot and right up to the very prosaic beige metal door that was the employee entrance. There was a keypad outside. Though I felt dismayed, Bill didn't seem worried. He looked down at his watch and then knocked on the door. There were some faint beeps inside, and Palomino swung the door open. She was balancing a room service tray on one hand. Laden as it was, that was an impressive achievement. The young vampire was wearing the same outfit I was, and she looked mouth-watering in it. But at the moment, her appearance was the last thing on her mind.
Get in,
she snapped, and Bill and I entered the grungy back corridor. If you got to enter the Trifecta as a guest, it was glittery and gleaming and full of the constant machine noise and the frantic human yearning for pleasure that fills all casinos. But that wasn't for us, not tonight. Wordlessly, Palomino set off at a fast clip. I noticed that she was able to balance the tray perfectly, no matter how much her speed picked up. I scurried after the two vampires along the beige-painted corridors, marred with scratches and chips. Everyone back here was in a hurry to get where they needed to be, either at a workstation or out the back door to go somewhere more pleasant. They were saving their smiles for people they cared about. I saw a half-remembered face among the grim horde, and after I passed, I recalled that she was one of the Longtooth pack. She didn't let on by a twitch or a smile that she knew who I was. Palomino strode ahead of us, her light brown skin looking warm, even though she'd been dead for years, her pale hair bouncing over a depressingly tight butt. We hustled onto a huge elevator. Instead of being lined with mirrors and shiny rails, this one was padded. The staff elevator was obviously used for bringing up pallets of food and other heavy items.
I hate this fucking job, Palomino said as she jabbed a button. She glared at Bill.
It's only for a little while, he said, and from his voice I could tell he'd told her the same thing many times before. And then you can quit. You can quit dating the wearer, too.
She was mollified and even managed to smile.
He's on the fifth floor, in 507, she said. I walked all over this damn hotel tracking him, but since they didn't station guards outside the room, I couldn't pinpoint it until last night when I took in the room service tray.
You've done a good job. Eric will be grateful, Bill said.
Her smile glowed even brighter.
Good. That's what I was hoping. Now Rubio and Parker may get a chance to show their skills.
The two vampires were her nest mates. They were not great fighters. I hoped they did have other skills.
I'll present that to Eric in the most urgent terms, Bill promised.
The staff elevator opened, and Palomino handed the tray to me. I had to use both my hands. Lots of food and three drinks weighed it down. She pressed the door's closed button and began to talk very quickly.
Keep your head turned away, and they'll think you're me, she said.
No one would think that, I said. But after a second, I could sort of see it. Palomino was naturally brown, and I was very tan. Palomino's hair was paler than mine, but mine was as abundant and long. We were much the same height and build, and we were wearing identical outfits.
I'm gonna go be conspicuous out front, she said. Give me 3 minutes to get within sight of the security cameras. I'll meet you at the back door 10 minutes after that. Now get off the elevator so I can go.
We got off.
Bill held the tray for me while I took my hair out of its ponytail and shook my head from side to side to increase my resemblance to the vampire.
As long as you had her here, why couldn't she have done this?
I hissed.
This way she can be visibly elsewhere, Bill said. If Felipe suspected her complicity, he could have her killed. He can't do that to you. You're Eric's wife. But that's a worst-case scenario. We'll pull the trick off.
He pulled a khaki fishing hat out of his back pocket and pulled it over his head. I forbore to comment on the way he looked.
What trick? I asked instead.
Well, it is a sort of conjuring trick, he said. Now you see him, now you don't. Remember, there are two guards in there with him. They'll open the door, and your job is to make sure it stays open. I'll come in and do the rest.
You couldn't just break the door down?
And have security here in 2 minutes? I don't think that would be a good plan.
I'm not sure this is either, but okay.
I marched down the hall and knocked on the door of 507 with the knuckles of my left hand, managing this by kind of wedging the tray into the corner formed by the door and its frame. I smiled big at the peephole and took a deep breath to let my chest do its thing. I sensed the appreciation through the door. I counted the heads inside the room, 3, as Bill had told me. The tray was not getting any lighter, and I was conscious of a definite relief when the door opened. I could hear Bill's footsteps coming up behind me.
All right, come on in, said a bored voice.
Of course, both of the guards were human. They would have to be on duty during the day, too.
Where you want this? I asked.
Over there on the coffee table will be fine.
He was very tall, pretty heavy, with very short gray hair. I smiled at him and bore the laden tray over to the low table. I squatted and slid it into place. The other guard was with Colton in the bathroom, waiting until I left to emerge. I read that right from his brain. The room door was still open, but the guard was standing close to it. After a second's anxious search, I spotted the plastic folder containing the check and handed it to the Hulk without getting closer to him. He made a little face, but moved nearer, his hand extended, the door he'd released beginning to swing shut. But in slid Bill, moving smoothly and silently at the man's back. While I kept my eyes fixed on the folder, Bill reached up and around to hit the man in the temple. The guard dropped like a sack of wet oatmeal. I grabbed a napkin from the tray and wiped my fingerprints off the tray and the folder while Bill shut the room door.
Dewey, said the man in the bathroom. She gone yet? Uh-huh, Bill said, deepening his voice.
The second guard must have sensed something was up, because he had a gun in his hand when he opened the bathroom door. He might have been prepared with weaponry, but he wasn't mentally prepared, because at the sight of two strangers, he froze, his eyes widening. It was just for a second, but that was all it took for Bill to leap onto him and sock him in the same place he'd hit the Hulk. I kicked the gun under the couch when it fell from the guard's hand. Bill hurried to pull the unconscious man out of the way while I darted in the bathroom to untie Colton. It was like we'd done this 12 times. I confess I felt pretty proud at the way it was going. I looked Colton over while I began working on the duct tape across his mouth. He was not in great shape. Colton had worked for Felipe in Reno and then followed Victor to Louisiana, where he'd been employed at Vampire's Kiss. His apparent devotion hadn't stemmed from affection, but from a thirst for vengeance. Colton's mother had died as a result of Victor's teaching a lesson to Colton's half-brother. Carelessly, Victor had never dug deep enough to get the connection, and as a result, Colton had been a great help to the Shreveport plan to eradicate Victor. His lover, Audrina, had taken part in the fight and paid for her devotion with her life. I hadn't seen Colton since that night, but I'd known he'd stayed in the area and even kept his job at Vampire's Kiss. Colton's gray eyes were full of tears after I yanked the duct tape off. His first words were a stream of profanity.
"Bill, we need a handcuff key,"
I said, and as Bill began rummaging in the guard's pockets to track it down, I cut the tape around Colton's ankles. Bill threw the key to me, and I unlocked the cuffs. Once I tossed them aside, Colton didn't know what he wanted to do first, rub his wrists or massage his stinging face. Instead, he flung his arms around me and said, "God bless you." I was startled and touched. I said, "This was Bill's plan, and now we've got to skedaddle before anyone comes looking. Those guys will come too eventually." Bill had reused the handcuffs on the Hulk and was using Second Guard's own belt to secure his arms. The roll of duct tape they'd used on Colton was also heavily deployed.
"See how you like that, motherfuckers," Colton said with some satisfaction.
He stood up and went to the door.
"Thanks, Mr. Compton."
"My pleasure," Bill said dryly. Colton seemed to take in my scanty outfit for the first time, and his gray eyes widened.
"Wow," he said, one hand on the doorknob. "When Palomino brought in the food last night, I caught a glimpse of her. I hoped she recognized me and would do something for me, but I never expected this."
He looked at me again before forcing his eyes away.
"Wow,"
he said and swallowed.
"If you've finished ogling Eric's woman, it's time to get out of here," Bill said.
If his voice had been dry before, it was toast now.
"Just don't let anyone see me," Colton said. "And after I get out of this town, I never want to talk to another vampire in my life."
"Though we've risked our lives to rescue you,"
Bill said. "Time to work out the philosophy later," I said, and they both nodded. In a second, we were on the move. I had a napkin in my hand, and I used it when I shut the door of 507 behind us. We went down the hall in single file and reached the staff elevator, passing only one couple on our journey. They were completely wrapped up in each other and didn't do more than stop groping for a moment in reaction to our presence. The staff elevator came quickly, and we stepped on to join a middle-aged woman who was carrying some dry cleaning in a plastic bag. She nodded to us and kept her eyes on the floor indicator. We had to go up with her before we could go down, and my palms started sweating with anxiety. She was ignoring Colton's disheveled condition with a deliberate air. She didn't want to know, which was great. It was a relief when she stepped off. When we began our descent, I was terrified someone would be waiting for us on the fifth floor. The door would open, and we'd be confronted with the two men we'd left bound. But that didn't happen. We got down to the second floor, and the doors whooshed open. There were several other workers there, another room service server with a rolling cart, a bellman, and a woman in a black suit. She was very well groomed and wearing high heels, too, so she was definitely higher up on the food chain. She was the only one who paid us any attention when they all crowded on.
"Server," she said sharply, "where's your name tag?"
Palomino had worn one on the upper slope of her right breast, so I clapped my hand to the place mine should have been.
"Sorry, it must have fallen off," I said apologetically.
"Get another one right away,"
she said, and I looked at her tag. M. Norman, it said. I was sure I wouldn't get a surname. Mine would say Candy or Brandy or Sandy.
"Yes, ma'am,"
I said, since now was not a time to start a class war. M. Norman's gaze went to Colton's handsome face, admittedly marred by the removal of the duct tape, and admittedly a little bruised. I could see a little crease between her brows as she tried to figure out what could have happened to him and if she should ask any questions. But her tailored shoulders lifted in a tiny shrug. She'd exerted her authority sufficiently for one night. When the elevator stopped at the ground level, we got out of it like we owned the hotel.
We rounded a corner, and there was the back door, Palomino walking toward it ahead of us. She glanced over her shoulder and looked faintly gratified to see us coming. She tapped the code into the keypad by the door, and then she opened it. We strode by her into the parking lot. Palomino, on the way to her red car, looked curiously at the street beyond the fenced lot for a moment, as if she sensed something strange. I didn't have time to check it out as we walked briskly between the parked employee cars and out the gap in the fence. We were almost to Bill's car when the Wares caught up with us. There were four of them. I only recognized one. I'd seen him at Alcide's house. He was a gaunt-faced, long-haired, bearded guy named Van. Vamps and Wares just don't mix, generally speaking, so I stepped ahead of Bill and did my best to manage to smile. "Van, good to see you tonight," I said, struggling to sound sincere when every nerve in my body was screaming at me to get the hell out of the vicinity. "You gonna let us get on our way?" Van, who was several inches taller than me, looked down at my face. He wasn't thinking about my body, which was a nice change, but he was thinking about making some kind of choice. It's very hard to read Ware thoughts, but that much I could discern.
"Miss Stackhouse," he said, and nodded.
His dark hair swung forward and back with the motion.
"We've been looking for you."
"How come?" I might as well get this settled. If we were going to fight, I needed to know why I was going to get beat up. I sure didn't want that.
"Alcide's found Warren."
"Oh, good."
I was really pleased. I smiled up at Van. Now Mustafa could come in from the cold, tell us what he'd seen, and all would be well.
"Thing is, what we found is a dead body. We ain't sure it's really him," Van said.
When my face fell, he added,
"I'm real sorry, but Alcide wants you to have a look at him and tell us it's Warren for sure."
So much for a happy ending. Chapter 12.
"You all were headed somewhere?" Van asked.
"We were taking this one to the airport," Bill said, nodding at Colton. This was news to me and to Colton, but it was good news. There really was a plan to get Colton away from the reach of Felipe.
"Why don't you two continue on, then?"
Van said reasonably. He didn't ask any further questions or demand to know Colton's identity, which was a relief.
"I can take Sookie to the body. She'll check the identity, and I'll get her home, or we can meet up somewhere."
"At Alcide's?" Bill asked.
"Sure."
"Sookie, you okay with that?"
"Yeah, all right," I said. "Let me get my purse out of your car." Bill clicked his car open, and I reached inside to get my purse, which held a change of clothes. I definitely wanted to find a couple of minutes of privacy to put on something a little less revealing. I felt uneasy without knowing exactly why. We'd recover Colton, and if he could get the hell out of town, he'd probably be safe. If Colton couldn't tell the little he remembered about the evening at Fantasia, Eric would be safer, and therefore I would be safer, and so would all of the Shreveport Vamps. I ought to be feeling happier. I slung my bag over my shoulder, glad that I had the Cluvial Door with me.
"You're okay with these wolves?"
Bill asked in a very low voice as Colton got into Bill's car and buckled a seatbelt. "Uh-huh," I said, though I wasn't so sure. But I shook myself and called myself paranoid. "These are Alcide's wolves, and he's my friend, but just in case, call him when you're on your way, would you?"
"Go with me," Bill said suddenly. "They can identify Warren by smell, maybe. Mustafa could definitely do that when he resurfaces."
"Nah, it's okay. Get Colton to the airport," I said. "Get him out of town." Bill looked at me searchingly, then nodded in a jerky way. I watched as Bill and Colton drove off. Now that I was alone with the werewolves, I felt even odder. "Van," I said, "where did you find Warren?" The other three crowded around. A woman in her 30s with a pixie haircut, an airman from the Air Force Base in Bossier City, and a girl in her teens with very generous curves. The teenager was in the first throes of experiencing her power as a Ware, almost drunk with her newfound ability. It dominated her brain. The other two meant business, and that was all I could get of their thoughts. We were walking north on the street to a gray Camaro, which seemed to belong to airmen.
I'll show you. It's a little ways east of town. Since Mustafa wasn't a PAC member, we never met Warren.
Okay, I said doubtfully. And I thought of making some excuse not to get in the car, because my uneasiness was mounting like a drum roll. We were alone on a dark street, and I realized they had boxed me in. I had no real reason to doubt that Van was telling me the truth, but I had an instinct that was telling me this situation stank. I wished instinct had spoken up more clearly a few minutes ago when I'd had Bill at my side. I got in the car, and the Wares crowded in. We buckled up, and in a second we were driving in the direction of the interstate. Curiously, I almost didn't want to discover that my suspicion was valid. I was tired of crises, tired of deceit, tired of life-or-death situations. I felt like a stone being skipped across a pond, longing only to sink to the anonymous bottom. Well, that was stupid. I gave myself a mental shake. Not time to long for things I couldn't have at the moment. Time to be alert and ready for action. "Do you really have Warren?" I asked Van. He was sitting to my right in the back seat of the Camaro. The plump teenager was crowded in to my left. She didn't smell particularly good.
"Nope," he said. "Ain't ever seen him, that I know of."
"Then why are you doing this?" I might as well know, though I already felt sadly sure this was going to end poorly.
"Alcide asked that black bugger Mustafa to join the pack," Van said. "He ain't asked us."
So they were all rogues. "But I saw you at the last pack meeting."
"Yeah, I was going through rush like they do in fraternities," Van said, deeply sarcastic. "But I didn't make the cut. Guess I got blackballed."
"I thought he had to let you in," I said. "I mean, I didn't know the pack leader got to pick and choose."
"Alcide is a little too selective," said the airman, who was driving.
He turned a little so I could see his profile as he spoke.
"He doesn't want anyone with a serious criminal record in his pack."
Alarm bells sounded then in my brain, way too late. Mustafa had been in prison, though I didn't know the charge. Yet Alcide had been willing to accept him into the pack. What had these rogues done that had been so bad that a wolf pack wouldn't have them? The girl beside me tittered. The woman in the passenger side of the front seat cast her a dark look, and the girl stuck out her tongue like a 10-year-old. "You got a police record?" I asked the plump girl. Plump gave me a sly look. She had straight brown hair that fell to her shoulders. Her bangs were almost in her eyes. She'd stuffed herself into a striped tube top and blue jeans. She was wearing flip-flops.
"I got a juvenile record," she said proudly. "I set my house on fire. My mama got out just in time. My daddy and the boys didn't."
And I got what her daddy had been doing to her, just a single line of memory from her, and I was almost glad he hadn't made it out. But the brothers? Little boys? I didn't think she was too happy her mom had made it out either. "So Alcide wouldn't admit any of you?"
"No," said Van, "but when there's a changeover and the pack has a new leader, we'll be in. We'll have security."
"What's gonna happen to Alcide?"
"We're gonna overthrow his ass," said Airman.
"He's a good man," I said quietly.
"He's a douche," said Plump.
During this charming conversation, the woman in the front seat had not spoken, and though I couldn't read her thoughts, I could read the ambiguity and regret that were making it hard for her to sit still. I sensed she was on the cusp of a decision, and I feared to say something that would tip her over to the wrong side. "So where are you taking me?" I said, and Van put his arm around me.
"Me and Johnny might appreciate a little alone time with you," Van said, his free hand lodging itself under my skirt. "You looking so fine and all."
"I wonder what you were in jail for," I said. "Gee, let me guess." The woman looked back at me, and our eyes met. "You gonna put up with that?" she asked Plump. Thus goaded, Plump grabbed Van's wrist and pulled his hand away from my crotch.
"You said you wouldn't do this again," she growled, and I mean growled. "I'm your woman now, no more." "Of course you're mine, but that doesn't mean I don't want to cleanse my palate with a little country fried steak," Van said.
Charming, I said, which was unfortunate, because Van punched me, and I saw bright lights for a second. You don't want to get hit by a werewolf, really. I had to keep from gagging from the pain, but I resolved that if I threw up, I was going to do it all over Van. He grabbed my hand and squeezed it until I could feel the bones rubbing together. This time, I had to cry out, and he liked that. I could feel the pleasure radiating out from him. Help, I thought. Can anyone hear me? No answer. I wondered where Mr. Catalides was. I wondered where his great-great-grandson, whom I'd always called Barry Bellboy, was. Too far away in Texas to hear my mental voice. I wondered if I'd see tomorrow. I had planned on it being a happy day for me, a special day. At least Van seemed to be taking Plump's hostility seriously now, and he quit hurting me. Dealing out pain to me excited her jealousy just as much as him feeling me up. Unhealthy. Not that it was my problem, not that it would make any difference after we got wherever we were going. I picked up on a stray thought or two. I was beginning to get the bigger picture. It had a big skull and crossbones right in the middle. The traffic was fairly heavy, but I knew what would happen to me if I signaled another car. I knew, too, what would happen to the people in that car. Not a single police car in the stream of traffic. Not a one. We were on the interstate going east, back toward Bonton. There were a dozen exits, and when we left the interstate, none of them would have this much traffic. Once we got into the woods, I'd be doomed. Well, I had to do something. Just as a motorcycle began passing the car, I attacked Van. He'd been thinking about something entirely different, something involving the Plump girl, so my sudden twist and lunge was a huge shock. I tried to grasp his neck, but my fingers wouldn't meet around it, and I had a hank of his hair bundled into my grip. He yelled, and his hands shot up to grip mine. I dug my thumbs in ferociously, and the airman turned to glance back. Glass shattered, and as I closed my eyes, I saw a fine mist of red. Someone had shot Airman in the shoulder. We were at a level spot on the interstate, thank God. As we abruptly swerved off the pavement, the quiet woman in the front seat reached over and switched the car off. Remarkable presence of mind, I thought in a daze, and we began gliding to a stop. Plump was screaming, Van was beating the shit out of me, and there was blood all over everything. The smell triggered the wolf in them, and they began to change. If I didn't get out of the car, I was going to get bitten, and then I'd qualify to be a pack member myself. As I struggled with Van in a vain attempt to reach the door handle, that door flew open, and a black-gloved hand reached in to grab mine. I seized it like a drowning man seizes a rope, and just like a rope, that hand hauled me out of deep trouble. I barely managed to grab my bag with my free hand.
Let's get out of here,
Mustafa said, and I jumped on the back of his Harley behind him, my bag slung over my shoulder and mashed between us to keep it secure. Though I was still trying to grasp what had just happened, my wiser self was telling me to think later, get the hell out of there now. Mustafa lost no time. Just as we zipped across the grassy median to head back into Shreveport, I watched a car pull up to offer help to the apparent wreck.
No, they'll get hurt, I yelled.
It's Longtooth wolves. You stay on.
And off we took. After that, I concentrated on clinging to Mustafa as we rocketed through the night. After my initial gush of relief, it was frustrating not to be able to ask any of the 50 questions racing through my mind. I wasn't totally surprised when we pulled up in the circular driveway in front of Alcide's house. I had to exert a conscious effort to unclench my muscles so I could dismount. Mustafa took off his helmet and gave me a thorough look. I nodded to let him know I was okay. My hand would hurt from the squeeze Van had given it, and I was covered with dots of blood, but it wasn't mine. I looked down at my watch. Bill had had time to deposit Colton at the airport, but he should be driving here. The whole thing had happened that quickly.
What you doing wearing prostitute clothes?
Mustafa asked severely and hustled me over to the front door. Alcide opened the door himself, and if he was bowled over with surprise, he did a good job of hiding it.
Damn, Sookie, whose blood? He said, and waved us in.
Rogue werewolf, I said. I reeked.
No cars coming, so I had to take action then, Mustafa explained. I shot Laidlaw. He was driving. The pack's taking care of the others. Tell me,
Alcide said, bending down to look me in the eyes. He nodded, satisfied with what he saw. I opened my mouth.
In as few words as possible, he added. Apparently, time was of the essence.
Palomino found where Felipe was keeping a guy hostage, a guy we needed to rescue, discreetly. I kind of resemble her, so to leave her cover intact, I pretended to be her wearing this waitress outfit.
I glared at Mustafa.
That the casinos picked out,
I added, to make myself clear. Alcide gave me a little shake to speed me up.
Okay. So Bill and I came out with the hostage, and we were going to drive off when this group of four wares comes up, and the leader, Van, whom I'd seen here, by the way, so I thought he was okay, Van tells us, you sent them to get me, and I need to come with them, because they found Warren's body, and they want me to verify that it's really Warren.
Alcide turned his back and shook his head from side to side. Mustafa looked down at the floor, his face a map of complex emotions.
So Bill headed to the away with the hostage, and I got in the car with Van and them, and I realized pretty quick that they were rogues because you wouldn't have them. That Van.
And then I just didn't want to talk about him anymore.
He hit you, huh?
Alcide said, turning back to eye my face. There was a moment of fraught silence.
He rape you?
Didn't have time,
I said, glad to get that out of the way.
I don't know where they were taking me, but Mustafa shot the driver and got me out of the car, and here I am. So, thank you, Mustafa.
He bobbed his head, still involved in his own thoughts, his own worry for his friend.
Was there a woman with them? Kind of quiet, about 30?
Pixie haircut?
Both the men looked blank. Real short hair, light brown, tall woman? Alcide nodded vigorously.
Yes, that's her. She okay?
Yeah, she was sitting in the passenger front. Who is she?
She's my undercover,
Alcide said.
You have undercover agents?
Yeah, of course. Her name's Candace, Candace Moffat.
Can you please explain all this?
I hated to sound stupid. Telepaths get used to knowing stuff, I guess.
I'll give you the Reader's Digest version, he said, to my surprise. But come in the bathroom and wash yourself off while I fill you in. Mustafa, man, I owe you. I know, Mustafa said. Just help me find Warren. That's all I need.
Alcide hustled me into a bathroom right off the entrance hall. It was all granite countertops and pure white towels, and I felt like the nastiest thing the cat had ever drug in. Alcide didn't necessarily mind the blood, because that's not a wear hang-up, but I sure did. I turned on the shower and stepped under it after shucking my shoes, which were the cleanest things I was wearing. When Alcide's back was turned, I stepped out of the waitress outfit and let it fall to the floor of the shower. I grabbed a washcloth, soaped it up, and began scrubbing. Alcide resolutely kept his eyes turned away.
Start talking, I reminded him, and he did.
After I talked to you about Janilyn, I began to think about her pretty seriously, he said. The more I took her recent actions apart, the more I thought I should look deeper. I figured out that Janilyn was not telling me the truth about a few things. I wondered if maybe she was skimming off the top at Hair of the Dog.